Thank you so much, Jenny. Thank you so much for inviting me. I should start by giving you two warnings. First, I know almost nothing about art. Second, I'm very sick. So, I have to inform the audiences I meet these days about this, because I feel so below any kind of decent intellectual standards, because my mind is completely foggy, but I'll do my best to not be embarrassingly dull. Alright, so I promised to give a deliberately polemical talk, so that means I'm going to attack new materialism. Please feel free to defend it and attack me back, those of you who would like to do so. I'm coming to this issue from a particular angle, from a particular standpoint. I teach a discipline called human ecology. I've mostly done work in environmental history. I'm obsessed with climate change. So this is work more in the field of environmental philosophy. It's not historical stuff. It's philosophical, analytical. It all boils down to how do we understand climate change and what are useful, helpful, analytical tools for understanding the situation we're in and how potentially to intervene in it. Okay, as I understand new materialism as an intellectual current, it emerged as a kind of reaction to the cultural turn or the preoccupation with discourse and text and sign in social theory and the academy, broadly speaking. And I think that reaction itself is very sound and welcome, because I think that the cultural turn in the 1980s and 90s meant that many thinkers, writers, scholars, including historians, moved away from matter and materiality and became obsessed with word plays in different forms. And the reaction to that turn was overdue, and the material turn, which is kind of a counter turn, where you're returning to materiality, is in a sense a step in the right direction. I also understand that it has released a lot of intellectual and aesthetic energies that applies to the field of environmental history, where many environmental historians feel emboldened by the idea that matter has agency, and that you can write histories about soil, about microbes, about mosquitoes, things like that, and consider them every bit as much agents as the traditional human protagonists of history. And I also understand that this can and has released aesthetic energies, because you can represent things. First of all, you can start care about things as bearers of meaning in various forms, and that opens up a new imaginative space, I guess, for people, that you can all of a sudden say or paint or whatever, do different interesting things with fatty acids or dogs or worms or whatever it is that the new materialist universe can be filled with. But new materialism isn't only materialism, it's also new. And that new flags a kind of distance from the supposedly old materialism, which is associated with what many of us would call historical materialism. Now, it feels a little bit old-fashioned to represent the old materialism. It's inherently more attractive with something new. I'm going to defend the old version here for different reasons. As I see it, the main difference between new and historical materialism is not the idea that materiality matters, or that our universe is fundamentally material and that everything that happens in society is at the root of it material. That goes for both schools. But what sets new materialism apart, as I understand it, is the insistence on matter as having agency, as doing things with the capacity of agency. And new materialists who are critical of historical materialism sometimes even like to argue that, that historical materialism isn't really a form of materialism because it portrays matter as a kind of stage, a background for the really interesting drama, which is always what goes on between human beings. Social relations are at the center of the historical materialist idea of how history works. And even although historical materialists emphasize that social relations are always material, it's human agents that are the protagonists of the story. And this, according to new materialists, almost makes historical materialism something else than materialism. So, some would say that it's more like a socialism, not in the sense that it's a political program for taking over the means of production, but that it's a conception of the world that privileges the social over the material. And the new materialists would say that we are the ones that are the true materialists because we attribute agency, the key property of any drama, to the things themselves, to matter. And two main sources of inspiration for this way of thinking are Bruno Latour and Jane Bennett. And Bruno Latour is this exuberantly creative thinker and incredibly influential in the humanities and social sciences, you probably know, over the past decade. And he's been arguing this for quite some time, that matter itself has agency. So, for instance, hammers hit nails. So a hammer has agency every bit as much as the human who holds the hammer. And he gives, you know, this table has a certain type of agency in holding up the papers here and the objects here. You know this kind of stuff. And Jane Bennett in her vibrant matter builds on this and elaborates on it as a kind of philosophical manifesto for new materialism. And when this is applied to climate change, as it has been by several thinkers by now in within this current, what it means is that we shouldn't see humans as the exclusive or even the central agents of the problem of climate change, but instead we should recognize the agency of clouds, of the oceans, of the cold, of the carbon dioxide, of the weather itself. It's a distributed swarm of agents or actants, as it's sometimes called, a term that comes from Latour. And adherents of this philosophy claim that this is how we make true sense of climate change, by dethroning humanity and distributing agency evenly in a way that is supposedly more reflective of reality. Okay. The central analytical category here is obviously agency. And there is a kind of folk understanding of what agency is that clearly has to do with goal. Being an agent, having agency, is generally, not by new materialists, but by pretty much everyone else, perceived as related to having a goal in your mind. So, for instance, when the sun rises in the morning, Malmö, where I live in southern Sweden, the rising sun itself would not be attributed agency by most people, including my daughter. But when I, as a parent, go into her bedroom and tries to wake her up to get her off to daycare, I am an agent. I have agency because I have a goal of waking my daughter up. And my daughter instinctively understands this difference, not of course that she philosophically reflects about what agency is, but she's not. She doesn't negotiate or communicate with the sun or questions the sun motives or tries to convince the sun that she wants to sleep for a little bit more time, as she does with me, because she instinctively distinguishes between a subject that comes into the room with a goal in mind and with the property of agency, namely her father in this case. And this agent is different from the inanimate object of the son. This is a very simple, common, popular understanding of what agency is, but it's also one that is in line with what pretty much every philosopher in the philosophy of action, which is a subfield of philosophy, thinks as well. And as every field of philosophy, this one is filled with controversies and debates about how to understand various aspects of what action is. But almost, well, I haven't come across anyone who deviates from this consensus. Everyone in this field agrees that to be an agent is related to having a goal. So there are lots of events in the world, but not all events classify as actions. For an event to classify as action, there has to be someone with some kind of a goal in mind. So, for instance, if I slip on a leaf and fall on a railway track, that happens. It's an accidental event. If I throw myself on the railway track with the intention of committing suicide, I act. It's an action, right? If the wind comes and blows down the leaves on the train, no one is involved who could even potentially be an agent. So there's no action involved. It's an event. Something happens. But no one participates in the unfolding of this event with a particular intention in mind, as I do when I throw myself on the railway tracks. So in the philosophy of action, this is analytical philosophy, not continental philosophy and things like that. In analytical philosophy, having agency is very intimately tied to having a mind. And often it entails that you act with your mind set towards a state of affairs that does not yet exist. So when I wake up my daughter, I act with the goal of having her awake. She's sleeping in this moment, but I'm trying to wake her up. So I intervene in the world with this goal that I have formed in my mind and try to impact my daughter to achieve this goal. Likewise, I might be alive, but I might want to end my life, and therefore I throw myself on the railway lines. And this is, as I said again, this is the consensus in the philosophy of action, which has been, as far as I can see, completely unperturbed by Latour and New Materialism, because I mean they speak in completely different idioms, and philosophers of action appear to, I would say, for quite good reason, take no heed of the arguments offered by Latour and his peers. This is also the position that has been espoused by historical materialists. There's a very famous line in Capital where Marx says that what's distinctive about human labor is that even the worst human architect forms a mental image of the house that he or she wants to construct before it's constructed. So human labor has a particular kind of intentionality to it. And this is in line closely with the consensus in the philosophy of action. Obviously, a theory can be common sense, and the consensus in the particular field of philosophy, and in line with historical materialism, and wrong. It might, of course, be the case that the new materialists have understood something about agency that everyone else has missed. And that's what they claim, of course, that they have done. And a key move in making that argument is to try to decouple agency from intentionality. So Latour and Bennett and others write about agency as something that can be possessed by entities without minds, by things that obviously don't have brains and so can't form goals, mental goals, to guide their actions. But they try to sever the link between agency and intentionality, and come up with definitions of agency that are very broad, almost to the point that I would say that they are watered down to almost nothing. So, for instance, Bruno Latour, he defines agency as the ability of X to make a difference on Z, something like that. The ability to make a difference is what is agency. And on this definition, obviously, everything has agency. I mean, everything that exists makes some sort of a difference to the world, right? That's what it means to exist. And if you define agency this way, everything has agency. And Latour has many examples of things that he believes possess agency to make his case. And I'll just refer to one of his examples. And it concerns two rivers, the Atkafalaya and the Mississippi rivers. You're American, so you probably know those rivers much better than I do. I haven't seen any of them. But the point here is that the Atkafalaya is a small river below the Mississippi, which is a large river. And the Mississippi would, at some point, flow into the other river, which is smaller and below the Mississippi, if it were not for various engineering works by the engineering corps or whatever it is down south. So, according to Latour, this means that the Mississippi River has a goal to merge with the Atkafalaya, and the Atkafalaya River has the goal of swallowing the Mississippi River. So this proves this sort of demonstrates that a river can have as much of a goal as any human agent. Now, I think that this dissolution of the centrality of human agency creates a kind of analytical impoverishment, because there are several central dimensions of agency that are being lost if we decouple agency from intentionality in this way, and attributes agency to things like rivers. And I'll try to go through some of the aspects that I think are being lost here. Imagine a situation where someone, a man, joins a political organization. Let's say it's on the far left. He can join this organization for different reasons. Let's imagine that he joins this organization because he's a police infiltrator and he wants to extract as much information as possible from within this radical group. This is one central aspect of human agency. One and the same action can be performed with different goals. So you can join a political organization with performing the exact same action but have different goals depending on what's in your head, right? I can join an organization because I honestly want to advance its cause, or I can join it because I want to subvert it from the inside as an infiltrator. And when the infiltrator is inside, he will take pains to behave exactly like any other member, but these other members might not understand what he is actually up to, because the real goal might be unavailable for third-person observation, that is, for observation from someone outside of the head of the agent in question. It might be that the agent inside this organization is the only person who knows what he's actually doing, because he keeps the goal to himself in his mind. And if all the others are unaware of what he's doing, he himself is fully aware of it. So third, the agent understands his own actions in terms of the goal that he has set for himself. Now, let's imagine that this guy joins the organization on the 1st of January in the year 2020, but that the scheme for infiltrating the organization has been developed over 2 or 3 or 4 years prior to his actually joining the organization. A goal can be formulated long before the plan for attaining it is set in motion. And as the infiltrator starts to work his way through the organization, he learns more about how to behave, he adapts his manners to the fellow members, he modifies his behavior to maximize the extraction of information. So five, the agent keeps track of the progress towards the goal he has set up and alters his line of action to reach this goal as effectively as possible. If he makes progress, he might feel pride. If he does not, he might feel ashamed of himself. So six, one who has a goal can evaluate his behavior in relation to that goal. And he might also, for some reason, not carry out the operation. Perhaps he receives counter orders from his superiors or something like that. So seven, a goal can exist without being put into practice because a goal is in the mind of the agent. Or the organization might fall apart while he's undertaking his infiltration operation. So then he can suspend his action. Eight, an agent can halt an action if the desire underpinning the goal disappears. And then finally, imagine that this guy comes to change his mind by, let's say, falling in love with someone in the organization, perhaps experiencing police repression firsthand, imbibing the literature of the group, and becoming convinced that this group is actually doing the right thing. So he abandons the police force and actually becomes a real member of the group. So nine, the goal as such can be revised and abandoned. These are just some, of course you could continue the list, but these are just some of the dimensions of agency that are intrinsically tied to the fact that agency is based on human intentionality, and that makes it something different than what a river do when it's, because of the laws of physics, pulled in the direction of another river. I don't think that there is any of these nine aspects of agency that are present in a river that is pulled in the direction of another one, right? And the key distinction here between inanimate matter and humans is, I believe, that humans have agency, whereas inanimate matter of all kinds has causal profile, causal impact. So this is not a way of saying that matter is insignificant, unimportant to the unfolding of history. Obviously not. I mean, the asteroid that most likely struck the Earth and extinguished the dinosaurs had an incredible impact on the course of evolution of the species on this planet. But it didn't have agency. That's the one property that it lacked. You can't say that the asteroid had set up the goal to strike planet Earth and wipe out the dinosaurs. It had a certain causal profile and causal impact, but it didn't have that goal. Is this of any importance? Well, in a sense, it can seem obvious, but it has, I think, some importance when trying to understand climate change, because the problem of climate change is a result of a certain interaction between human beings and fossil fuels. Human beings have dug up fossil fuels and set them on fire and done this on a very large scale over quite some time now, and this has caused a rise in temperatures. Now, humans have conducted these acts with certain intentions in mind, and the classical intention, if you look at the extraction of fossil fuels, is and has been to make money. That is, you've had agents who have organized extraction of fossil fuels, starting with the coal mines in the United Kingdom, in and before the Industrial Revolution, up until today. And they have invested in infrastructure for digging up fossil fuels and sell them to marketplaces with the intention of making money. Fossil fuels themselves have had all the impact on the climate of the Earth. But fossil fuels themselves have never had agency in climate change, because no piece of coal has ever asked to come up out of the ground, or tried to jump into a fire, or sought to somehow get itself out on the marketplace. The privilege of agency here is and has always been exclusively human. And fossil fuels have never done anything. They are, by their nature, completely passive. They lie still in the ground, in eternal stillness, for hundreds of millions of years, outside of the carbon cycle, until some humans come along and dig them up and set them on fire. And this is very much the case still today, where you have a whole category of corporations that are immensely rich and powerful on this planet, that are animated by the intention of digging up fossil fuels and making more money. And these are the corporations that that scour the globe constantly for new reserves of coal and oil and natural gas to explore. One would think that this would at least slow down in this rapidly warming world, but it's not. It's not slowing down at all. We have companies even in my part of southern Sweden, which is a complete backwards area for the fossil economy, looking for opportunities for fracking. We have coal companies that are planning for the relocation of villages in eastern Germany to make room for more coal mines. We have the corporations that seek to build more pipelines in Canada or in this country. We have the companies that look for ways to expand coal mining in Zimbabwe and in South Africa. That prospect for oil in the marine park of the Great Australian Bight in the Arctic and so on. All those corporations that frack and bore and dig and hack their way through the crust of the Earth. And they have the intention of getting the fossil fuels out of the ground and getting them sold and getting them burned so as to make money. And this has been made very explicitly clear by Rix Tillerson in his famous statement, "My philosophy is to make money. If I can drill and make money, then that's what I want to do." And well, he has the refinement to talk about philosophy here, so we can just as well subject this to a little bit of a philosophical analysis. What he says here is that that my philosophy is to make money. So that's his prior intention, his fundamental goal that he has formulated for himself is to make money, and this before developing any particular plan of action about how to actually go about making money. But if I drill and make money. Meaning that, okay, so if this is the line of business that I have decided to pursue to make more to make money, then I am going to do it. that's what I want to do. Suggesting that in action, his intention will not be, of course, it won't care about any obstacles. If I can drill and make money, then that's what I'm going to do, right? And this is a unique human agency that drives the problem of climate change, and it implies, I think, that it's more important than ever to uphold the lay distinction between things that don't act and humans that do act. And this has, I mean, this isn't really very difficult for political movements to understand. So it's not something that I feel that I need to go and preach to the climate movement, for instance. Let's take the anti-war movement. Obviously, you can go and organize a protest against the military invasion. You go into the government building and say, stop the war or something like that. But no one would ever protest, rally against an earthquake. You know, you go to a fault line and say, don't erupt in an earthquake. No one would do that. And likewise, when it comes to climate change, you don't organize a protest against Hurricane Sandy because you know that this hurricane doesn't have any agency. It's not an agent. There's no agent behind the event itself, unless you believe that storms are spirits or something like that. But you can actually contest the something like the construction of the Keystone XL or the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's where you can intervene. And I think the climate movement has recently been quite consistent in targeting the fossil fuel industry, because that is where you find the most concentrated intention to get the fossil fuels out of the ground and set them on fire. And this is so dangerous precisely because it produces consequences such as more hurricanes. So inanimate matter is, in a way, triggered to behave in a certain way by the human actions, but all the political energy, by necessity, has to be targeted, has to be directed against the target of the human agents behind the actions of extracting fossil fuels. Now, what would new materialism do to climate politics? What can it contribute? Well, my impression is that there is very little in the way of positive contribution, because what I have gathered from scattered writings on climate change by new materialists is that what they can say that no one else says about climate change is that no, it's not humans that do these things any more than it's the coal itself, or the clouds, or the ocean, all the other components. So in the discussion around the Anthropocene, for instance, some new materialists have argued that we should skip the talk about the Anthropocene as the age of humanity, because it's not really humanity that has caused climate change. It's called as such, so we should call it the Carbocene, or the Anthracocene, after the Greek word for coal. And I think this just leads in completely the wrong direction. It has very little to do with the fundamentals of climate science, because what climate science tells us is that it's humans, no one else, who have dug up fossil fuels and put them on fire. And the honor, if it's an honor, it's more a dishonor, but the honor of agency in this development belongs exclusively to the humans who have extracted and sold and bought and combusted fossil fuels, and who maintain this these circuits up to the present. Okay, I just wanted to briefly mention also that I think this kind of insistence on a historical materialist understanding of agency is required not only to understand climate change but other kinds of environmental crises that we're dealing with, or not dealing with rather, at the current moment, such as, for instance, the biodiversity crisis. I don't know if you've seen the reports. They might not have reached you here in the US, but there is an incredibly rapid collapse of biodiversity going on in Western Europe right now, where you see bird populations completely collapsing in countries like Germany and France, because insect populations have been completely collapsing also. Why is that? It's because the EU has maintained an agricultural policy that consistently favors large-scale, heavily mechanized agriculture that spews out pesticides on the fields to kill as much insects as possible to maximize yields. And this is a system maintained by the agricultural subsidies in the EU.
And the effect is that insects are extinguished from the fields, and therefore you have entire ecosystems unraveling with the food chains collapsing and the birds disappearing. And this of course will not only produce a biodiversity desert, but it will eventually also have very serious impacts on food supplies and on human societies. And I don't see this as being understandable if we try to distribute agency evenly, or say that this is produced by a swarm of agents. It's clearly human agency, and not agency by humans in general, but in this case by the ruling class, as it is organized through the state apparatus of the European Union, that through its agricultural policies has caused and is causing this environmental disaster. Okay, finally, I just wanted to say something about what this might entail for issues of aesthetic representations of climate change. And as I said from the beginning, I don't know anything about art, so I'll limit my remarks to literature. I know a little bit more about literature. I'm not an expert, but in discussions about how or why is it so difficult to represent climate change in fiction, there are people have come up with many different answers. But there is a relatively vibrant field of climate fiction, as you probably know, in recent years, with quite a few novels coming out about a rapidly warming world and what it might look like. Most of those novels are set in the future and describe one or another catastrophic scenario. And some of them are quite good. But so far, I haven't read a single one that integrates the burning of fossil fuels as a human action with the outcome of global warming. So let's take a novel such as Claire Vey Watkins, if I remember her name correctly, her book Gold Fame Citrus, which came out a couple of years ago, which portrays California maybe 100 years from now, where the drought has led to a desert swallowing the entire state. So all of California is basically a desert. This book makes for quite interesting, imaginative representation of climate change. But as all other novels about climate change, it doesn't have any component of the cause of this event, namely the extraction and consumption of fossil fuels. So the effect of these representations of climate change is paradoxically to naturalize this phenomenon, to make it appear as a natural force without roots in human actions. You see my point? So it just comes across as one more act of God, not that there's any explicit reference to divine intervention, but act of God in the sense that this is a mysterious or natural event, not linked to any preceding history of fossil fuel consumption. And it seems to me here that in literature, the great challenge, imaginative challenge, and the challenge for representing this problem is to try to integrate within one imaginative arc the action of fossil fuel consumption and the outcome of global warming. So far, Cli-Fi has exclusively described the outcome with the unintended, I think, result of almost contributing to its naturalization. The real political and aesthetic task to me seems to be to denaturalize climate change by linking it in some kind of narrative way with its preceding human cause. It doesn't seem to me that this should be an impossible nut to crack, because we have great novelists who can work across large spans of time. So you could say that the narrative problem here is how do you link the event of fossil fuel combustion with outcomes that necessarily come much later. There is a temporal gap between combustion of a certain quantity of fossil fuels and the resulting warming. But I mean, you have novels coming out all the time that have these epic plots spanning centuries. Think of Yagayashi's Homegoing, for instance, that came out the other year about the history of slavery in West Africa and how it ties into race relations in the United States today. It covers something like four centuries. So I don't think that this should be impossible for novelists. But I think the challenge here for an aesthetic praxis when it comes to representing climate change that is rooted in a historical materialist understanding of agency is precisely to try to integrate the component of human agency and relations and power as the central driver of changes in our material environment, most obviously with climate change, but other types of environmental crisis as well. All right, that's what I had to say. And please feel free to object to anything that I've said now. And yes, or Jenny, do you want to chair this?
I don't
know. No, you don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm happy to ask questions, but let others go.
Okay.
Yeah, listen, Andres, you start off talking about the 80s and 90s with the linguistic term of postmodernism, in other words. That had a huge impact. Everywhere you look, every campus, it was departments were just like swamped with people, you know, lecturing on Lyotard and Baudrillard and so on. What I'm having trouble understanding is this new materialism, which I only first heard about after finding out that you have this new book out, was it's the first time I even heard of it. And it's the first time I even heard of Bruno Latour. What I'm trying to figure out is, are these people like on aiming to refute historical materialism in the way that people like the postmodernists were? What kind of influence they have? Because like I say, I try to keep track of these trends. And I honestly, I never heard of them before. I mean, I'm glad you wrote the book and everything, but what's going on?
To be honest, I'm happy you haven't heard of it, and you should consider yourself privileged to not having to deal with it. To be very frank and crude, this book that I wrote is, like I've said a couple of times, in itself a performative contradiction, because I don't really care that much about those things, to be honest. And I begin the book by saying that I don't think theory is that supremely important. But then I write a whole book about it, as though it really is super important. But I mean, in the very tiny bubble that I live in or work in, environmental history and environmental humanities, energy humanities, kind of some sort of vaguely progressive academic project in trying to understand the environmental crisis in its various dimensions. This kind of thinking is influential. Bruno Latour is probably the most influential social scientist that has been active over the past two decades. At least one of them. Incredibly influential he basically invented an entire field. STS, what does it stand for? Social
Science and Technology.
Science and Technology Studies, yes, thank you. And others in this room can probably support me in the impression that this is a very influential current in academia and to some extent also, I guess, in the art world and in maybe not so much in literature. Yeah, in literature as well, yeah, for sure. But not in fiction itself, perhaps, but I agree with you. If you have a feeling that why does this matter so much? Maybe it really does.
I was very receptive to your idea that at this moment, individual human agency is very important. I just wonder how you would apply that to systemic structure, the agency of groups, and the interaction of groups when it comes to goals of making money or of intervening and stopping the installation of a pipeline, for example, and an industry that is, you know, so systematically entrenched. Where you assign agency there, and how you see that developing?
Very good question. So one of the most interesting fields in the philosophy of action, I think, is the one that is concerned with collective agency. So there's a lot of discussion between philosophers. I should say I'm not a philosopher by training, but so I'm an amateur and dabbling in these things. But some of the philosophers of action argue that you can actually say that collectives can be agents in themselves. And others would say, no, only individual human beings can be agents, properly speaking. I'm quite inclined to go for collective agency. And I think the arguments that I have seen for it are quite convincing. I take in the book the example of one of my favorite brass band, Rebirth Brass Band from New Orleans. When they play the song "Feel Like Funkin' It Up," you don't say that every individual or that one individual member of the group plays "Feel Like Funkin' It Up." You say that the band plays "Feel Like Funkin' It Up" because it's the intention of the band to play the song and to produce the sounds, the groove, the vibe of the song. You have to perform the song as a collective. So Rebirth Brass Band is the collective agent that intentionally produces the song "Feel Like Funk It Up" in a New Orleans second parade or something like that. And likewise, a corporation can have agency. So the corporation, ExxonMobil, has the intention to extract fossil fuels and sell them and make as much money as possible. That's the intention of the corporation as a collective agent. And people who work in the corporation as individuals, let's say oil workers, they may or may not have internalized this intention and made it part of their own, you know, soul, their deep conviction in life. But as members of the organization, they have to, because they're employed by it, strive towards this goal that is the goal set up by the corporation. And likewise, you can potentially have collective agents that challenge oil corporations with the opposite intention, namely to keep fossil fuels in the ground. That's the goal set up by the climate movement. Very much a future-oriented, almost fictional goal, in the sense that it's a state of affairs that doesn't exist. But it's the state of affairs towards which the climate movement is striving. And I cannot stress enough that I don't think that individual agency is going to change these things. It's a matter of building a collective agent with power enough to achieve the goal of keeping fossil fuels in the world. There was another hand somewhere. Yes, please.
What do you think of Timothy Morton's work on climate change?
So my book is an exercise in making as many academic enemies as possible. And I'm sorry to say that he's one of them. So to be honest, I'm not very impressed.
Who is he?
Who is he? Who is he? Yeah, he's one of the great stars of the material turn and the object-oriented ontology and those currents. I mean, partly this has to do with intellectual temperament. I mean, I like analytical precision. Others like other ways of expressing things. It's partly a matter of taste, I guess. I mean, he likes to say things like, oil has dark designs of its own, or the car winks at me knowingly, or things like that. I mean, he has a particular way of performing text that some people find very exciting. I don't. But it has, I mean, it partly has to do with intellectual taste, I guess. Yeah. But it's if you're asking me for my subjective opinion, this is my opinion. Yes.
Well, obviously, there's the politics and Marxist politics associated with historical materialism. I think there's a kind of politics associated with this sort of new material term, this new materialism. I mean, how would you situate it ideologically?
I mean, I would not be so crude as to say that new materialism is neoliberal or bourgeois or something like that. I think someone like Jane Bennett is a progressive left person. I just don't really see the political utility of it. And I don't know that it has a secret political agenda or anything like that. I just think that it serves to depoliticize rather than politicize things. Let me take one example. The case of the of the border walls, the fences that have gone up in Europe since the so-called refugee crisis in 2015. You can either look upon those fences as being matter endowed with agency, vibrant matter, or you can see them as things that do not in themselves in any way possess agency. They are only bearers of the agency of other of people whose intention it is to keep persons that are not white out from Europe. This is the way to politicize border fences, to say that the fences themselves have absolutely no agency. They are just the carriers, the material embodiments of intentions of certain humans that want to keep other humans out. The new materialist instinct would presumably be to try to attribute agency to these things themselves, and that would, in my view, only serve to depoliticize what's called.
It's reification.
Yes, it's reification. It is reification. Next time. Yes.
Just to piggyback off of that, because I'm sort of, I mean, I found your sort of discussion of semiotics and what led to this sort of birth of materiality or new materialism. If you could just maybe look at it almost from a reporting perspective, or just what like might be the impetus besides that, and it's kind of touching on your political question that led to this. Like, I could say, well, maybe it's a way of just not facing the changes that we have to make as a culture by giving agency to everything else and not me. I don't have to worry about it. Does that, am I clear?
Yeah. And I think that if you want to understand it culturally if you ask yourself, what is this a symptom of? As a historical materialist, you can quarrel with a theory and try to disprove it, and after it you've successfully disproven it, the next question is, what is this a reflection of? And I would say that it's a reflection and a symptom of a general feeling of powerlessness. And that feeling in itself is entirely understandable. I feel that, I have that feeling too, that we are in the hands of overwhelming forces that we cannot control. And one way of trying to articulate this is to say that it's the things themselves that have taken control. And there's nothing special about human agency. We can't shape the world. The world is shaping us. That's a feeling that many people have for pretty good reasons. And in this sense, new materialism is, I think, a reflection of the crisis of political subjectivity. Mm-hmm. It's the disappearance of the political collective subject from our culture that, you know, has many morbid symptoms, including certain intellectual currents that, you know, kind of make a virtue out of the absence of agency by saying this is how the universe works. There's nothing special about human agency. I don't think that people could say that in 1968. New materialism in 1968 would have made no sense, you know, at that political moment or in the 1920s. But nowadays, people have the sense that we can't shape this world. The world is shaping us. We can't do anything about it. and attributing agency to things is a reflection of that extremely deep reification of our culture. That would be my answer to the question. But let's see, I don't know if I've kept track of the hands here, but I think, yeah.
Well, thank you for your lecture. I think, though, just to maybe shift the tone a little bit, to me, when you were making the example of both the rivers and then later on giving this, the sort of like the qualities of agency that it certainly did not have, I think in parallel you made an argument for it, the virtue of new materialism, which is also new to me in this, so probably not giving you, like, responding to this totally correctly, but there seems to be so many nested layers of agency that we're reflecting on. So, for example, you gave the example of the infiltrator, right? To some extent, it's kind of irrelevant what the individual infiltrator's goals are. Actually, he was just operating from the goals of his organization.
Hmm.
And as an individual, it gets really hard to try to, like, constantly find the right level of what is the agent that's acting towards me right now.
Hmm.
And I feel that what new materialism seems to open up is this possibility that there are gradients of agency, and sometimes the right category to look at is what then in which you disregard agency. And you said it right in the beginning that if you just take existence as such and call that agents, well, then everything has agency. And I kind of resonate more with that, in that, well, let's not talk about agency at all. Let's just look at the world, what's happening, and find out the right action and not who caused this thing towards me or to the coal. That actually, if I were to give coal an agency, and with the laws of physics, is to remain in the ground.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so I just wanted to give, like, a sort of, to me that was a positive description of that. Well, there are useful perspectives in which, like, you can disregard agency and or give agency to everything because they're equivalent.
But my question then would be, how would this play out in climate politics? I mean, who would you address your demands to, or who would you target? Who would you protest? Who would you approach?
I would say that, well, that's not necessarily what they set out to answer.
No, sure.
And B, you were making this example with the sun rising versus you waking up your daughter. Well, when the storm is coming, you might reflect on agency the day after, but when the storm is coming, you know that it wants to get into your house, so you barricade, right?
Yeah, of course.
Meaning that, like, in some sense, agency is really secondary to action. And I don't know I can't reflect on what does that action mean in relation to all of these agencies, but, like, there are certain actions that don't need to be considered within an agent framework.
But I think that political action is all about agency. I mean, when I barricade my apartment to prevent the storm from breaking in, I'm trying to survive, and I'm trying to negotiate the storm as a physical force, but that is not in itself a political action. Political action is when you, as a subject, somehow confront another subject because you want to turn the world in a different direction, including one where hurricanes do not become more powerful all the time. So for me, if you're talking about political action, you need to try to define yourself as an agent, collectively speaking, and your enemy. And Bill McKibben has argued this, and I think he's absolutely right, that progress on climate change requires that the movement defines an enemy. And that enemy isn't very difficult to see. It's not like we need to invent it. It's just that we need to open our eyes to it, because it's clear who the enemy is. I understand what you're saying about we can skip the terms, we can skip the discussion about agency, and I myself haven't really cared for the category until those people come along and say that there's nothing special about human agency. I think that is quite bad timing, because if there is some moment when we need to insist on the burden that humans and humans alone have, it's this moment. You know, if
right now, the actions of humans will determine how the biosphere evolves for a very long time. So to come in this particular historical moment and say that there's nothing that sets human apart from chairs or pieces of coal is bad timing. Yes.
I did, but I'm okay.
Anyone else? Yeah.
You spoke about decoupling agency from intentionality as it relates to matter and then human agency. And then I felt like maybe there was something in between in terms of design and infrastructure as it relates to like the hammer and the table.
Yeah.
I was wondering where that sits in your argument and how you, whether you have a way to kind of like separate those stages of something within agency.
I think that the grain of truth and the rational kernel in actor network theory, Latour and Unitary and all of this, is the realization that matter often carries agency in different ways. So Latour has two famous examples. He has many, but I'll just mention two. One is the case of a hotel where the owner of the hotel is tired of the guests walking away with the keys. So he makes sure that the keys become so heavy that the customers want to drop the keys before they leave the hotel because they don't want to carry those heavy keys. So to him, this is an argument for the keys having agency. Another
because someone might have made those keys deliberately heavy.
Yeah, exactly. That would be my kind of problem.
Okay.
This is obviously a case of the keys having embodied the agency of human beings. That is, some human being has kind of outsourced its agency to inanimate matter. And the other example that I could just mention is that in a university campus, cars come and drive and they drive too fast. So the administration decides that we have to install speed bumps to prevent accidents. And this too is a case that shows that the cement structure of a speed bump has agency in stopping cars from driving fast. But again, to me, it proves just the opposite, that the matter here is a carrier of human agency, just like the fence on the borders of Eastern and Central Europe. And to politicize technology and matter is, I think, to try to identify what interests technology and infrastructure serve. I mean, what are the material interests served by, for instance, us having amazing aviation in Europe but no railway infrastructure that works? That's a certain type of physical embodiment of the interests of certain people, I think. But you're absolutely right. It's crucial to see the agency in things, but not to see the agency as belonging to the things themselves. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the back, please. No, you.
Oh,
you, yeah.
It was largely answered in your response there. I guess one thing that I thought, I appreciated your sort of psychological determinations of why this movement happened, but I also kind of feel like it's really internal to philosophy, where it was like an answer to the linguistic turn.
Yeah. Yep.
I think people were trying to see whether this divide between epistemology and ontology could be, you know, bridged again. And in some ways it felt like I was also kind of puzzled as to why it became such a big thing in the art world, because if it's an ontological statement, what is only to suggest that there was something more than like this kind of hopelessness.
Yeah.
Well, I could argue that you're not being polemical enough, especially against the tour, where people are asking, what are the politics animating this? And his politics are quite bad. And his he explicitly says that he's anti-Marxist. And of course, he grows up on this rich, you know, winemaking family. And he has all the politics that go with that. I would also say, in terms of like why is it popular, and I'm thinking about, the question is, how do we talk about new materialism without just making it sound dumb, right? Yeah. As in, and not to give it credit, but to maybe understand it. And I would say, from my own field in environmental history, I think a lot of people were just excited because that was like the first time philosophers actually talked about nature.
Yeah.
And that historians were always looking for the imprinter of philosophy to say, as a, yes, you're smart now, more or less, and so they could just cite someone. And I guess it just talks about the impoverishment about environmental philosophy generally, that there was no one else to draw upon. But I want to say one thing, I think the biggest contribution I thought of your work was to say that this nature and culture is a use, to me, you have to always try to separate the two when we do look at certain things. So I think it was, because a lot of people would think it was actually a progressive move to say that they are combined, that they are together and get over, you know, dualism or Cartesianism or whatever. And you're taking the very unfashionable, I think, correct move and saying, actually, it's very useful separating. So if you speak more about especially the last point, I think that is probably the biggest contribution you make.
Yeah. Thanks. Just quickly on Latour and not being polemical enough, I agree with you that his politics has for long been explicitly anti-Marxist. Ironically, it seems that he's changing right now. So just before I came here, I was in Paris, and I have a friend there who is apparently quite close friends with Latour. And Latour's most recent book in French, which is a short one, is apparently the most politically radical book that he's ever put out. And according to this friend of mine, what's happened to Latour is that the election of Trump incited in him or triggered in him a kind of personal crisis, because he had this feeling that he was partly culpable. You know, he had himself contributed to post-truth and this kind of anything goes epistemology that underpins the Trump phenomenon. You know, Latour's background is in extremely constructionist understanding of what science is, that you scientists basically make up facts. So apparently he's been in a crisis since the election of Trump, and I don't know to what extent he really blames himself for the election of Trump. That would probably be another case of his narcissism, but he seems to be moving politically, and I think someone like him can afford to move politically in more radical directions because the left is so extremely weak, and because he doesn't need to prove his credentials as an anti-Marxist, so he can probably afford to say some more critical things right now. We'll see what this book actually entails when it comes out in English.
Didn't something like that happen a couple? Because he was a fellow at the Breakthrough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and
sure.
Then they issued that Eco Modernist manifesto, and he turned against it.
Denounced
it.
Yeah.
It seems like this has been going on for a while.
Do you consider yourself a Marxist?
Do I consider myself a Marxist? I consider myself a revolutionary one. For sure. Absolutely, yes, 100%. I just wanted to briefly comment on the question of nature and culture. That's a kind of a part of my book that I haven't really touched upon here. Like, why is it important to distinguish analytically between what's nature and what's social? But I don't. Maybe we don't have time to go into that, but I do think that agency is something that belongs on the social side of things. Should I add something on the Marxist question? I mean,
no, I asked a simple question, you gave a simple answer.
I mean, I don't know how strange it is in the US or in New York to say that you're a revolutionary Marxist. It's pretty strange in Sweden.
I think it depends on who you're talking to.
Sorry?
depends on who you're talking
to. Yeah.
But I do. I think that what I was going to say before, when I raised my hand, I really have no skin in this game. I have nothing that I do professionally concerns new materialism, except perhaps relating to art. That's tenuous.
Yeah.
But I would say that in terms of like the political associations with new materialism, I think that perhaps because you're so ardently and convincingly present your own position, I think it's probably worth noting that the genesis of this idea comes from the desire to, as far as I understand it anyway, that there is some interest in taking away this idea of privileging humanity in a hierarchy that has a global implication of allowing humans to escape culpability towards damaging. So in fact, that's the sort of ecological interest in new materialism, is to get humans to say, well, bees are important, and they have agency, and rivers are important, and they have agency, and that by not owning those facts, that a new materialist may argue, if you are not acknowledging the agency of bees and rivers and trees, then you are sticking with this human worldview that has really just fucked us so far, right? And so that what has happened, and how somebody like Latour can feel a sense of guilty conscience, is that what has happened to those individuals is that they're positions, and in some cases their science even, has been co-opted by the right, people who are libertarians and extreme conservatives who want to use that as a way of disavowing climate change. People like the Koch brothers who invest money in movies that sit with the agenda of saying, like, this is how evolution works. We've always had all of these actors and agents in the world. So there was, you know, dinosaurs died for a reason that had nothing to do with humans, and humans are going to die for a reason that has nothing to do with humans, too.
Yeah.
So this is like, those are the political and the, I think that the genesis of new material that I think just is kindly to mention that
people
are not like total idiots or assholes.
No,
like,
yes,
there
absolutely.
Is a reason behind it, and it is because for hundreds of years where human figured out that they could, or not hundreds, tens of thousands of years where humans figured out that they could dominate other species, they pay little respect for the role of that species in the world and in its ecosystem.
Yeah, it's very good that you bring this up. And I think you're definitely right that this is the ethical thrust of the writings of someone like Jane Bennett. She and other new materialists want to cultivate this kind of sensibility towards the non-human world, and they believe that that's conducive to an environmental politics. Donna Haraway is thinking along similar lines. Now, the objection that I would make is the one that I've taken from Kate Soper, whose work is absolutely foundational to this book that I wrote. It's a philosopher in England I admire enormously. And her argument is that any appeal to humans to change their ways and the way that they relate to other species presupposes that there's something special about humans, that they can deliberately modify their behavior towards other species. You don't, to put it very crudely and simply, you don't go to the wolf and tell the wolf, behave differently in relation to your prey. But to a human, you can say, stop torturing the cow, or stop eating it, or stop emitting all those greenhouse gases that kill wildlife around the world. So Kate Soper's argument is that if you want humans to care about other species, you need to insist on their humanism,
mm-hmm.
as an ontological position. That is that humans have a particular kind of very central agency,
mm-hmm.
that other species don't have. We alone can trash the planet the way that we're doing right now. No other animal species could do that. And we alone can stop trashing the planet. I mean, the polar bears will never stop climate change. We, the humans, are the only ones who could do it on behalf of polar bears and other non-human species. So Kate Soper's argument is that the ethical thrust of this position is the correct one, but it leads in the opposite analytical direction if you take it seriously. I think Jenny, did you raise your hand?
No, I was just going to say thank you. Like, maybe this is a good time to
end. Yeah.